From Illinois Public Media, this is Thumbs Up. WILL looks at Ebertfest 2015.
Welcome to the 17th annual Roger Ebert Film Festival. We have to give a golden thumb to you.
We're in the middle of the 17th annual Roger Ebert Film Festival, Ebertfest. It's that time of year when Champaign-Urbana plays host to film critics, directors, producers, stars, fans, and many more as we celebrate films of every different genre. This hour, we're going to explore this year's Ebertfest. We'll talk to some of the special guests, visit some of the events, find out what it takes to run the festival, and more. But first, the news.
Welcome to the 17th annual Roger Ebert Film Festival. This morning, I took a walk, walked over to the Virginia Theater so I could visit Roger's sculpture. And I asked him to be with us this weekend and let his spirit, what he created 17 years ago, to continue.
Wednesday marked the opening of the 17th annual Roger Ebert Overlooked Film Festival, Ebertfest. It's that time of year when Champaign-Urbana plays host to film critics, directors, producers, stars, and more, as we celebrate films of every different genre. From the opening picture, an experimental French film, the festival's first ever 3D picture, to an upcoming Jason Segel release, to a silent film, Son of the Sheik, diversity is a given. I'm Amanda Hunnickfort. And this is Thumbs Up. WILL takes a look at Ebertfest 2015. This hour, we're going to explore this year's Ebertfest. We'll talk to some of the special guests, visit some of the events, and take a look at the newly announced Ebert Center in the University of Illinois College of Media. We're going to start with one of Saturday's pictures, 99 Homes. 99 Homes tells the story of a young contractor, played by Andrew Garfield of Spider-Man fame, who is hit hard by 2007's economic downturn. His family is evicted from their home, and, in an attempt to provide for his family, he begins working for the very person who evicted him. Noah Lomax plays his son, Connor. Lomax will be in town for the film's Q&A session, alongside his director, Ebertfest regular Ramin Barani. Lomax and I started with how he got into acting.
Me and my family were at the mall, and we saw this thing. When we thought you could just sign up and meet famous people from, like, Disney shows and stuff. And so my sister signed up, and then we found out what it was. And they got her all situated with an agent and stuff. And then they asked me if I wanted to try it, and I did. So, yeah.
Cool. What is it about acting that appeals to you?
What I love is I love getting to be a different person every time I book a role or have an audition. And I also love getting to be behind the scenes and getting to see how they make the movies. And when I get older, I may want to be like a director because I just love making videos on my phone and stuff. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's kind of hard to say at 13, I'm sure. But,
yeah.
You know, you're looking at all the different aspects. You don't know, you know, you're not sure yet if you want to continue in acting or?
No, I definitely want to continue. But when I get older, I may want to do something else.
Okay. Cool. So tell me about playing Connor in 99 Homes.
I really loved the character because it was just something different than all the other movies I've done. Because all the other movies, it's really just a son of one of their parents that's been through a lot, I guess, and been divorced. But in this one, it's a whole different character, a whole different story. So it's pretty fun to get to film it with Andrew and Laura.
Mm-hmm. Was there, you know, a scene or something that really stood out to you?
I mean, the eviction scene was really, it made me really realize how fortunate I am to not be evicted from my home. And because seeing that, I get to see how other people have to go through things like that. And it must be really hard.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're talking a lot about seeing how it worked for other people and what people went through. Is there a lot of preparation?
When I first got it, Ramin sent me a bunch of websites to go look at so I could watch like 60-minute videos of people living in motels after they've gotten evicted and how they get evicted and kids living in motels. So, yeah, I had lots of preparation.
Was there a story of any of the kids that you really latched onto when you were figuring out who Connor was?
Well, this was actually 2 years ago, so I can't really remember.
Mm-hmm.
But most of them were just, one of the people asked one of the kids if they could have one wish, and he said, "I wish I could redo my life," and that just really stuck with me, so.
Mm-hmm. So Ramin's been here to Ebert Fest and to Champaign-Urbana before, but, you know, I don't think you have. Is there anything in particular you're looking forward to, or any expectations about what it's going to be like?
Well, I've never been, like you said, and I'm very excited because I've never been to Chicago, and my favorite hockey team plays there, and I've always wanted to go. But I've been to Toronto Film Festival, so I know what, like, the film festivals are like, but I'm not sure if this one's different or similar. So I'm really looking forward to seeing how it's going to go.
Cool. Yeah, we're very different. We're more about watching than distribution. So I understand that that when you were auditioning for 99 Homes, it ended up involving a lot of improvisation, and some of that made it into the film?
Yeah, well, when we were auditioning, Ramin really just, I went in and I was ready. I had the lines memorized, and that wasn't really useful because we didn't really have to go over the lines. He just told me about the scene, and we did improv like an hour. We were in there for a really long time, and we had really great chemistry. It was just really fun. And in the film, there wasn't much. You didn't really stick to the lines. It was lots of improv, which I really love. So,
how does improv differ to the more structured, already written out scenes to you and the way you do things?
I feel like it's more real. And it's more natural because it's like a real conversation rather than having to memorize lines for a conversation.
You mentioned earlier your sister does this too. You worked with her when you were on Walking Dead. What was that like?
It was really fun to work with my sister for the first time. And it was just me and her had a great time. But that was the only time we've ever worked together. And she actually doesn't do acting anymore. But it was really fun working with her on there because it was just like real chemistry, just me and her.
Mm-hmm. Cool. What about being on Walking Dead in general, you know, especially considering how big that show has gotten?
Well, I don't really think of it like, oh, I was on The Walking Dead, but it has gotten pretty big, and it's pretty cool that I can say that I've been on it. But it was just 3 episodes in the first season, and me and my sister were really, really small, so
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, very often your roles, you're working with other actors who are playing your parents, and that's a really close relationship to portray. How do you develop rapport with them before you start filming? You know, I imagine you don't have a lot of time to get to know them.
I mean, me and Andrew and Laura, we actually spent all the time we could together. We went out to dinner. Andrew and I actually went to the zoo. We spent a lot more time than I expected, and that really helped. So it just came across as a real family because they really did feel like family to me.
Very cool. Any other projects on the way?
I just filmed a pilot for a new TV show called Heart Matters.
Oh, fun. I look forward to seeing more about that as it gets closer. I'd imagine it's probably kind of hard to balance work and school and everything else. Do you find that difficult?
Yeah, it's pretty difficult, even though I'm homeschooled. We don't have a lot of time because, like, during pilot season, we have to go to auditions and we have to go over Los Angeles. And it's kind of hard to keep up with school, even on the weekends, because we end up getting there and it ends up good.
That was Noah Lomax. He plays Connor Nash in 99 Homes, directed by Ramin Barani. Lomax stars alongside Andrew Garfield, Laura Dern, and Michael Shannon. 99 Homes will be shown on Saturday at 9 p.m. We are now going to take a broader look at the festival as a whole with Michael Phillips, film critic for the Chicago Tribune and Ebert Fest regular. We started by talking about what he's most looking forward to seeing at this year's lineup.
I'm always eager to see whatever the silent film feature is going to be because I always end up on that panel. I love seeing work that rarely gets screened properly on a big screen with 1,000 people, many of whom were seeing it for the first time. This year it's going to be Son of the Sheik, which was a rather unusual sequel for the day. Rudolph Valentino had a huge hit in 1921 with The Sheik, one of his most famous roles in. This was the long-awaited sequel, and it's if you've never heard the Alloy Orchestra play an astonishing variety of instruments, it's just great. I mean, when they accompany a silent film, it's just really, it's like the fourth dimension's explained to you, and this is how silent films are meant to be experienced, you know. So I love that. I mean, I'm really eager to see the end of the tour, which I have not seen. The biopic on David Foster Wallace, who is played by Jason Segel, who's coming to town. So it's, you know, there's a lot to look forward to. And I think for a lot of people, it's just going to be fun to see Chaz Palminteri come through with A Bronx Tale and just to kind of hear what it's like to work with De Niro and, you know, what he thinks of Champagne Urbana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems interesting to have a film like The End of the Tour on the schedule that hasn't had a chance to make many theaters yet. It seems like a lot of the films that are shown at Ebert Fest are ones that people have had the chance to see but maybe wouldn't have gotten around to before Ebert Fest brought
them. Right. I think what you're going to find as Ebert Fest continues is audiences will find it a stimulating kind of combination of what you're talking about, which are films that have already received a lot of attention on the festival circuit but have not entered the commercial run in the theaters or on VOD. That's one group of film. And then there's another group of films or films that have been out maybe just a year or so, like Wild Tales, that, you know, found an audience, and in the case of the film that won the foreign language Oscar this year, Ida, from Poland, which is terrific, that's a film that found a really considerable audience internationally. So Wild Tales and Ida, yeah, about a year old. Then you get films like A Bronx Tale, which has been around several years, but maybe it's just a matter of aligning the right people. Chaz Palminteri is available. The producer, John Killick, I think is a good friend of Ebert Fest, and his excellent taste for a producer. He can talk to a lot of different issues. And then you get stuff like Son of the Sheik from the silent era. And I think as Ebert Fest moves into the future, you're going to see that it's really just kind of reflecting a lot of what Roger believed in when he was alive, which is champion the small films that nobody knows, champion the small films that people might know the title, and maybe the film did get a limited release, but it didn't quite get the love it deserved. And then simply take a chance on a piece of cinema that's maybe years and decades old that's worth considering.
Mm-hmm. Do you see pros and cons to a festival like Ebert Fest as opposed to maybe a more larger traditional distribution-based festival like Sundance? Or
I'll tell you, the pros are legion. It's such a pleasure and a relief after wrangling with a big, rangy, overwhelming slate you'll find at something like Sundance or Cannes, to just kind of go to a much tighter, more tightly curated and, frankly, festive, smaller festival like Ebert Fest that really doesn't require any difficult decisions of the moviegoer. Which one am I going to go to? Well, you can go to a mall here. You know, there's no choice. There's not a matter of like three or four or five movies screening up against each other. And it's unapologetically the reflection of what used to be one critic's really interesting and engaging taste. Now it's the reflection of a small group of Roger's closest colleagues and what they feel is worth championing. And a lot of that is filmmaker-driven. You know, Ramin Bahrani's coming back with 99 Homes. He's a friend of the festival. He was a personal friend of Roger's. And, you know, that's a film that's done well on the festival circuit from Venice on forward. The size and the compactness and the user-friendliness of Ebert Fest is not necessarily unique in the film festival world, but it's never been bettered, I think.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite story from your years coming to Ebert Fest?
I've never had better conversations with moviegoers ever. The audiences are so sharp and enthusiastic and well-schooled and just really happy to talk movies with you. It's really something else, and that's a real testament to the kind of film goer Roger fostered, I think.
So obviously, you know, it's up to Chaz and the College of Media, but is there something that hasn't been to Ebert Fest that you'd really hope would get screened?
Huh. Well, there's a film. I mean, it might be something for next year. It's pretty harsh, but it's an American independent film called Heaven Knows What that I saw in Toronto last year. That is a really startling portrait of junkies in New York, and it's kind of a weird hybrid of documentary and narrative feature, in that the people on screen are, in fact, recovered or recovering junkies playing variations of themselves, and it's a really intense experience. It's something else. Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of film I would love to see there next year.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That sounds like something that would fit.
It's good, yeah, right. But, I mean, you know, you look at the list here and you get some stuff that's Goodbye to Language, which is going to open the festival. It's typical for Jean-Luc Godard. It's a really, really challenging, non-linear, non-narrative essay. And anyone going in there expecting a straightforward story is going to be fleeing. They'll run, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a pretty stimulating and visually fantastic experience. I've seen that film twice, and I don't even pretend to parse it any more clearly the second time, but it's well worth championing.
Mm-hmm. So it's safe to say that you've watched a lot of movies. In your opinion, what is the best conditions in which to watch a movie?
Well, I'll tell you, the Virginia Theater is right up there. I love seeing movies with a big, enthusiastic crowd of 1,000 or so. I love seeing movies on 35 still as often as possible. Not everything is, you know, being shown at 35, obviously. And digital's clearly won that battle. But I love a big screen. I really love it. And when you get a good print of a movie, new or old, that's well projected with a really good receptive audience, and then you get a good discussion going afterwards, I mean, this is kind of heaven.
Mm-hmm. Have you developed any rituals or habits when you're going in to review a movie?
You know, I always try to check my teeth before going on stage to do a discussion, because I eat a lot of popcorn in my life. You know, I love coming back and staying at the Student Union every year. That's kind of a great little hotel setup they have within the Student Union. And, you know, I've only hit the Steak and Shake on my own. I've never really done a group thing at the Steak and Shake, but it's a wonderful place to meet, you know, people. I loved meeting Ali Erkan from Istanbul, who's a traveled film critic, and I met at Ebertfest a few years ago, and it was just such fun. He was one of Roger's far-flung correspondents and a really interesting critic in a lot of ways, and he was thrilled that he could find somebody in Illinois, in the heartland of America, who was as crazy about the Turkish filmmaker Nuri Bilge Ceylan as I was, and Roger's festival was the reason we got together. And that's what that festival's about. It's meeting new friends and meeting up with old friends. And that all sounds like a bunch of hooey and promotional nonsense, but it's really true. That I think people use Ebertfest to restore their film-going spirits.
So this year, Chaz Ebert and the U of I announced a new film department, the Ebert Center,
right,
which you are very involved in.
Yeah.
How did you become involved in putting together the Ebert Center?
I talked to Jan Slater, the journalism department, and Nate Cohen, who administers the Peabody's, among other things, but has also been intimately involved with getting Ebert Fest up and running every year. And we came up with this idea of having a couple Roger Ebert fellows, scholarships for undergraduates, who are interested in writing about film, writing about arts, entertainment, and culture, and all kinds of things. And they realized that it would really be best if they had sort of a mentor advisor working them through the year and trying to get them to think and write more perceptively about what it means to cover this stuff. And also not just for print and online, but maybe for radio and television. And the U of I journalism program has, it seems to me, has great connections with your outfit, WILL, and a lot of other places. So a lot of the groundwork's already laid. I think it's going to be great. It's a brand new experiment, but I've worked with students of all ages at various writing workshops, teaching situations, and I love it because I get more out of it than they do. It's just wonderful to think about why this piece works and this piece doesn't. And this is what we're going to do. We're going to figure these things out together.
That was Michael Phillips, film critic for the Chicago Tribune. We want to spend a bit more time looking at the Ebert Center that was announced earlier this week. As part of Ebert Fest, one of the panels discussed the plans and ideas for the forthcoming film school within the College of Media. Full disclosure, WILL is part of the College of Media. Chaz Ebert sat on the panel and started by talking about how she hopes the Ebert Center will increase the number of women in film and in the engineering work needed to develop film technologies.
Both Roger and I are technologists as well as storytellers, and I think that it's really important. I want to see what we end up with, what kind of stories will emerge from there, and the marriage of technology and storytelling. I think that we have a responsibility to society, inspiring and encouraging a generation of people who don't want to just make, you know, Grand Theft Auto or something where you see people shooting, killing, maiming, raping, having women as just objects of sex or degradation, and telling stories that create some sort of empathy, compassion, kindness. And when I say those words, I really mean them. They're not said lightly. And when Roger said those words, he really meant them. They weren't said lightly. So that's one of the things that I want to see encouraged in the Ebert Center.
Much of the panel focused on how the Ebert Center would be different than already existing schools. Not only will the Ebert Center keep inspiring its students as part of its mission, it will be a place where the arts and sciences meet and where the technology needed to tell stories in a different way will be created. Jason Brett, film producer and University of Illinois graduate, summed that idea up.
The relationship of artists and engineers and artists and scientists is, goes way back. It's a bridge that doesn't need to be built. It exists already. And it's a love of story. It's a love of imagination, of inspiration. And in fact, many of the best filmmakers, as we know, are also extraordinary scientists. I mean, somebody like Jim Cameron, the guy goes high, goes low, he creates incredible technology. And then you've got lovers of science, like Ron Howard and Brian Grazer, who just 2 days ago announced that they're going to be doing a new 6-part series for National Geographic in partnership with GE called Breakthroughs, all about innovations and the stories around them. And the one thing that connects everybody, as Donna was just saying, is story, narrative. It's why we're all here. It's what connects us as humans. It's what Joseph Campbell talks about. We dream the same dream. We have the same characters. So I think a bridge is an interesting metaphor for the discussion today because it is that thing that characters traverse. It's got thresholds. And what happens in between those two thresholds, the beginning and the end, is the journey of life, and that's what connects all as humans.
That was Jason Brett, film producer and University of Illinois graduate. We have more on what not to miss, what it takes to put EbertFest together, and a look back at comedy king Harold Ramis. Plus more. But first, we need to take a break because it's Pledge Week. It won't be long. Stay with us. Hi. So, since you're listening to the online version and not the on-air, you're missing the 8 or so minutes of Pledge, but there should be a Donate Now button at the top of the page if you're interested. Thanks. Back to the show. Welcome back. We're taking a deep dive into EbertFest today, and right now we have another look at some of the highlights of this year's festival. Jeff Bossert spoke with film critic and movie mom Nell Minow earlier in the week. They started by comparing EbertFest to other larger distribution deal-focused festivals.
I have been to Sundance, but in that case, I was actually listed as a filmmaker because I was in a movie. I was in a documentary about the financial meltdown, which was one of my specialties as a lawyer. They couldn't be more different. They're completely different in every way. Sundance is movies that are hoping for distribution, and Rogers Festival, which he used to call the Overlook Film Festival, is primarily films that have already been released and that deserve a further look and greater appreciation. And that's one of the things that I really love about this festival. I've discovered some wonderful films that way that I had never had a chance to see. I'm looking forward to doing that again this year, and I'm looking forward to helping people meet some films like Ida that they may have missed because they didn't play in their towns. And the other big difference is that in most film festivals, so most film festivals, you're just under this tremendous pressure as a filmmaker to find a distributor, and you're competing, and that's not the case at EbertFest, and so that gives it a completely different sort of chemistry. There is such a unity of purpose and experience at EbertFest that it creates an immediate sense of community for just those 4 days every year. All of a sudden, there is a town called EbertFest, and everyone who lives in that town is a neighbor of everyone else who lives in that town. And we go to films together, and we sit together, and we eat together, and we share this incredibly privileged experience. And that's something that I really cherish about EbertFest.
I'm wondering how you first got involved in it, how you first became friends with Roger Ebert, and he asked you to be part of it.
I grew up in Chicago and the northern suburb. I lived in Glencoe, and I began reading Roger when I was a teenager, and he started writing movie reviews for the Chicago Sun-Times, and my mother, who was trying to get me to pay more attention to what was going on in the world, put the newspaper in my hands, and she said, I know you're going to like this. He's only a few years older than you are, and he's writing reviews of movies. And I was in love with the movies, and I was just thrilled by the idea that this new young critic had started writing. And then when he and Gene started doing their TV show, back when it was a local show in Chicago, I started watching it. And I remember how exciting it was to hear these passionate conversations about movies, and not just about movies that were in the theater. This was before the multiplex era, but the equivalent of the suburban multiplex, but independent films. I still remember them talking about independent films and international films that really expanded my view of what was possible to see and what it was possible to aspire to as a film. So I was always a great fan of Roger's. And then several years ago, Roger reached out to me and said, we are going to be presenting a family film on Saturday morning at the festival. We'd like you to come out and present it. So I immediately said, well, that's a great film. It's just not a very good film for families. It's got a lot of violence in it. but he handled that very well, and he said, well, we'll put an advisory in the write-up so the parents know what they're getting into. And that was my first time coming to the festival, and I had a wonderful, wonderful time.
Okay, I have to ask, what movie was that?
It was The Fall.
Oh, okay. Do you have a favorite story from your time now that you've gone a few times and, you know, gotten to maybe meet some filmmakers and actors, et cetera, you haven't conversed with before?
My favorite experiences at Ebert Fest, the three times I've gone, are the people that I've met, particularly the far-flungers and the demanders, Roger's coterie of curated, aspiring critics. Every one of them has been just so bright and so knowledgeable and wonderful, and I've, you know, stayed friends with them on Facebook, people from all over the world, and that's been my favorite thing, are these wonderful friendships.
Yeah, and you mentioned Roger's wanting you to introduce a film that you didn't figure is family-friendly, so we should talk about your role as the movie mom, but you review everything.
I do. Well, you know, I've raised kids, and I can tell you that the hard part is not so much figuring out which of the G and PG rated films are appropriate for kids. It's when your kids get to middle school and high school and they're not going with their parents, they are going with their friends, where you really need some guidance. And when I say that I give parental guidance, I'm not kidding, because a lot of people tell me that they read my reviews so that they can know what's appropriate to take their parents to.
I think it's interesting that the end of the tour is at Ebert Fest. Here's a movie
surprised to see that. I'm very excited. It's a real departure. They're having their first 3D film and their first pre-release film. And that is a great tribute to Roger and to Chaz and Nate and Mary Susan and what they've been able to create.
Other movies, obviously, Chaz and other people here at the College of Media have the final say, but are there movies you would still hope to see in future Ebert Fests?
I would never. I don't think I could possibly do better than they've done. I like the way that they have certain traditions. They always have the silent film with the Ally Orchestra. I'm very excited to see Son of the Sheik this year. I've never seen it, and to see it with the live music is going to be just a stunning experience. And they also, Raman Barani was a great find of Roger's, and it's wonderful that he'll be there again this year. And the community welcomes us. We'd love to go to Steak and Shake.
What excites you the most about the industry today, or maybe what irks you the most?
Well, you know, one thing Roger and I disagreed on was 3D. He was not a fan of 3D, and I like 3D, and so I was very, very pleased to see that we are opening up with a 3D movie, certainly a very extraordinary one this year. And I think what I am most excited about that's going on in film right now is that pretty much anybody can make a movie, whether it's through Kickstarter or GoPro or distribution through video on demand, the democratization of film is following the democratization of journalism. That means you're going to have a lot of bad stuff out there, but we already had a lot of bad stuff. There's already a lot of bad movies being made. But what this does is it opens up the opportunity to anybody to make a good movie, and we're going to see some extraordinary things. I love what Joseph Gordon-Levitt is doing with his project. He's got a new one right now where he's asked people to make little videos of some place in their hometown that people from outside the town don't know about, and it's just extraordinary to sit and watch that. So I really, really love that. And so as big a fan as I am of the bombast and the big budget films, and I loved Guardians of the Galaxy, as much as I love the fact that we can now make superhero movies and there is no limit to what you can do in terms of creating Asgard or special effects or blowing up whatever you want to blow up, I love the fact even more that technology's made it possible for movie-making capacity to be in the hands of anybody who's passionate about telling a story.
That was Jeff Bosser talking with film critic and movie mom Nell Minow. Minow can be found on her Movie Mom website and on RogerEbert.com. We've talked a lot about what is happening this week and what has already happened. One such event is a tribute to Harold Ramis, who died in 2014. Ramis was the creative force behind movies such as Groundhog Day, Animal House, and many, many more. Chaz Ebert told Wednesday's opening night audience that she and her husband, the late critic Roger Ebert, loved watching Caddyshack over the years. During the tribute, she and film producer Trevor Albert reflected back 35 years to when he and Ramis first worked together. Caddyshack was Ramis's directorial debut and the first film role for comedian Rodney Dangerfield.
I have to say, when I was 21 years old working on that movie, if anyone would ever have said all these years later that Roger and I love that movie, you know, two intelligent people, I would have thought they were out of their minds. So it just, you know, speaks to the, you know, unpredictability of movies and how things are going to last.
In fact, Roger was actually was going to start a movement to get I don't get no respect.
Rodney Dangerfield.
Inducted into the Academy of Arts and Sciences because, you know, Rodney would, we would see him sometimes and he would say, you know, I made so many movies, I don't get no respect. You know, the Academy, they won't, they look at some of these people they put on their committee and they won't, I've made them billions of dollars and I don't get no respect. And Roger said, we really should, Rodney Dangerfield really should be a member of the Academy of Arts and Sciences so he can vote for Oscars as well. And I don't know if he ever even got an honorary one. But
I don't. The Academy doesn't have great regard for comedy. And that's sort of been a tradition which sort of continues today. And, you know, I don't understand it exactly, but Rodney he was never in the Academy, nor did he ever win an Academy Award. Nor has anyone really used those two words together, Rodney Dangerfield, Academy Award.
But to vote on one, he didn't have to have won one.
Let me just say one thing about Rodney Dangerfield. And Rodney Dangerfield had never been in a movie before. He'd never acted before. And this was part of Harold's thing. In the midst of all the insanity, he was able to find a center, Erica said in his thing. He always had his feet on the ground. Nobody else had their feet on the ground on that movie. And Rodney Dangerfield was literally like a cartoon character on the set. I mean, he was so over the top. And yet Harold, in the midst of all this, could sort of, you know, put a hand on Rodney and say, all right, let's do it this way, let's do it that way. And, you know, and out of the corner of his eye, he'd see Bill Murray pushing Chevy Chase in the lake. You know, it was like, but he managed to make everybody feel like they were important, that they were heard, and bring out the sort of best, comedy in them. And part of it was encouraging the improvisation. So that was part of his conducting insanity.
I also want to ask, Trevor, you got a chance to watch his evolution over the years from being an actor and being a writer and being a director, and I want to know a little bit of what you observed in him as he moved from these various roles.
On Caddyshack, the first day of shooting, we were all standing around, and the actors got in their places, and the sound person said rolling, and everyone looked to Harold to say action, and he had no idea he was supposed to say action. So he says, he jokingly says it was $7 million film school, Caddyshack. He literally learned how to make a movie. And that's extraordinary because having been around the process of making movies, it's terrifying. You have 150 people waiting and you have the studio. So the fact that Harold was confident enough that he could be put in that position and not really be intimidated by it, I mean, he was like game. He felt like he could handle it, he could master this thing. And so the evolution was, took him no time at all to figure out the technical stuff, which wasn't that hard. And I think the evolution was just trying to find what he was interested in, what stories he was interested in telling and still making them entertaining. You know, Animal House was broad, but it was, you know, sort of about class. You know, there was as was Caddyshack, as absurd as Caddyshack was, I think Harold and Doug and Brian would all say, yeah, it was about the struggle. We were poor kids and we were, you know, in this environment where the rich kids were at the country club and we were getting them, you know, their coffee. And so all his, even his early stuff, although you look at it and say, that's just, you know, good fun, there was something that he was trying to say. And I think that developed as the years went on.
That's producer Trevor Albert talking about Harold Ramis's legacy as a filmmaker. Ramis's widow, Erica Ramis, told the audience about how her husband always strived to be happy, even in the most difficult situations.
In work, in family life, in friendship, he was curious. He loved words. He loved evolution. He loved the evolution of ideas and spirit. And he used to say that his body was just hanging around to hold his brain. And I think he really meant that.
That was Erica Ramis, the widow of comedy king Harold Ramis. Another big event was the packed screening of The End of the Tour. The film is based on a book by a journalist who covered a few days at the end of David Foster Wallace's book tour for The Infinite Jest. David Foster Wallace is a Champaign-Urbana native. During the Q&A afterward, Jason Segel talked about why he wanted to play Wallace, a departure from many of the roles he's played before.
I think the goal of all kind of art endeavor is honesty. And so I look back, the first thing that I ever really wrote was Forgetting Sarah Marshall, and that's a comedy, but that was as honest as I knew how to be at the time. I felt like that guy. And so I think that I recognize what James recognized, that there is so much humor in David Foster Wallace's writing that I really related to. But what I really related to more than anything when I read Infinite Jest, I related really hard to this idea that pleasure and achievement and entertainment are not going to satisfy this other feeling you have of not being enough. And I had just finished a TV show and doing a ton of interesting things and writing movies, and none of it's, I really related because none of it scratched this other feeling of something is missing. And when I read Infinite Jest, I felt like I really understood it for what it meant to me. And so I didn't feel scared to do the movie because I felt like I just really felt like he is a surrogate for this thing that sometimes we don't acknowledge that we all feel. Of like, wait, isn't there supposed to be more than this?
James Ponsoldt, the director, visited EbertFest 2 years ago with The Spectacular Now. He talked about how the project started. A friend of his contacted him about the script. Ponsoldt, a great admirer of Wallace's work, was a bit nervous to read the script.
I had a feeling in my gut that it might be good, and when I read it, it just moved me to my core because it didn't try to be anything more than what David Lipsky's book is, which the best parts of it are Wallace's voice at that time, point in his life. Wallace was 34, Lipsky was 30, Jason, as it happens, was 34, Jesse Eisenberg was 30. David Lipsky at that point, I think, was really obsessed with maybe being the smartest guy in the room. He certainly felt insecure around Wallace, and that book, I think, is someone in their mid-40s looking back and wishing they could have done it differently.
Though Wallace taught at Illinois State University in Bloomington Normal, and part of the film took place there, they were unable to film in Illinois.
I went to Bloomington Normal. I went, you know, I had some very kind folks who are actually thanked in the credits, who showed me where he worked, showed me where he lived, showed me where he ate, all of that. The film itself was not shot there for really dumb film reasons having to do with tax incentives. We shot, I'm sorry, in Michigan.
Those were excerpts from the Q&A with actor Jason Segel and director James Ponsoldt after the screening of The End of the Tour. Ebert Fest is a celebration of film, a celebration that takes a lot of preparation and behind-the-scenes work to come off smoothly. The woman running much of that for the past 14 years has been Associate Director Mary Susan Britt. She's been with the film festival since its fourth year, back in 2001. This year, however, is her last. Britt and her family are moving to Louisiana in June. When Jeff Bossert caught up with her, she reflected on how she first came to the University of Illinois and what it was like to work with Roger Ebert.
We moved here from Vicksburg, Mississippi, and it was November 2000. And I remember the day we moved into our house, it was snowing, and it didn't stop, and it stayed 0 degrees for at least 30 days. And so we moved here, and I just remember telling my husband, I just want to work for the University of Illinois. And so we saw the ad in the paper for... it was College of Communications at the time. And it talked a lot about Roger Ebert's film festival and some other things that went along with the job. And I said, oh, I've never done a film festival. And he said, why don't you apply? You never know. And then look now, 14 years later.
So did it sink in at the time what it would be like that you would be working with a Pulitzer Prize-winning film critic and an icon and a hero in this town?
Right. At the time, I just thought, oh, wow, that would be so neat or cool to work with Roger. And then it just really didn't sink in until a little bit later when I actually met him and started working with him, you know, kind of day in and day out. So it was just fantastic.
Do you remember your first conversation with him?
You know, I just remember I met him 2 days after I started on the job. And it was just like, you know, he was just like, welcome aboard, Mary Susan. And
were you nervous about reading Roger, or did you just sense such at ease right away?
I was nervous. I'll never forget. I put on whatever, my best suit or whatever I had that day, you know, and I was very nervous. I'll never forget my neighbor. She stopped by to bring me something that morning, and she goes, gosh, you're all so dressed up. What are you doing? I said, I'm meeting Roger Ebert today. And she's like, wow. So that was fantastic. But, no, he put me at ease right away, of course. You know, he's just that type. He just was always like that. So, yeah, absolutely put me at ease.
I mean, maybe I could ask you to tell me a quick story or two. I mean, I know that he introduced you to Steak and Shake. Do you remember the first time you went there? Or?
Well, right, because, you know, we had moved here, and I don't know why we had not gone to Steak and Shake. I don't know why, but anyway, and so I actually went the first time during Ebert Fest with Roger, how they do and make that pilgrimage over there after, you know, the screenings at midnight. And so that was the first time. And so I say Roger was the first one that took me to Steak and Shake.
Do you have a favorite screening? You've done, 14 years of this? Do you remember? I mean, maybe one with the Q&A afterwards that really stands out. Maybe the audience was surprised and the audience really got into asking questions. Or maybe there are a couple that stand out to you.
Oh, gosh, that's like asking me. I don't know. I was talking to somebody about this the other day, and I don't know what it was. But I just remember 2006, just that whole festival in that year. It was just so wonderful and magical, and every year is. But somehow that year stands out in my mind. And I know that, you know, Nate and I talk about this because that's the year he came with the movie Somebodies. But it just seemed like everything was just, you know, everything was on fire, as in it was like, you know, just, I can't explain it. It just seemed like a great year. But every year's a great year, so I can't, you know.
Well, do you have any special stories in interacting with a particular actor or director or somebody like that? Because that's when you mentioned the year, I thought maybe it was one of the guests that year.
Yeah. I don't know. I just think the film lineup was great that year. But every year it's great. So it's so hard to, I wish I could think off the top of my head and think about, you know, all the wonderful guests that have been here and how wonderful. And, of course, you know, we all know Tilda Swinton and all the, you know, lovely things she says on stage. And, she, you know, of course, she's so brilliant and articulate. And so just how she talks about Roger and, you know, what a wonderful man he was. I mean, it's just, you know, that stands out in my mind. And especially with the kind of dance along thing we did, you know, in memory of Roger and all that year. So it was fantastic. So.
What are you going to miss most about being here? Another question that you can't answer.
I don't know. I'm just going to miss the community and, you know, just the entire, you know, everything that goes into the festival. And I tell people this all the time. It's just the community has been so great, and the campus community, and just, you know, working with everybody and pulling this thing together every year. It's just hard to pinpoint one thing, but it's just everybody comes together for this festival, and we would not have it without the community, for sure.
Tell me what you're going to be doing. You're going to the Louisiana?
Oh, so yeah, we're going to move to Shreveport, Louisiana, and my husband is working in Natchitoches, Louisiana, and so and it's a small town, and so we're going to move about an hour south or north of there, but I don't know what I'm going to be doing, so it's just crazy.
Have you researched any Southern Film Fest that you might be able to attend or maybe help out with?
Yeah, you know, I did. I looked into that. I think there's a big kind of production community there, and so I did. I have looked into that a little bit. Their Louisiana Film Office, which is the equivalent to our Illinois Film Office. A lot of the movies had been made there. And so, I'm going to look into that a little bit, but I'm just not sure what I want to do.
Oxford has a pretty nice one that's growing.
They do. Oxford, Mississippi most definitely does. They got James Franco this year there. So, absolutely. So, they do. They have a wonderful, wonderful festival and a lovely thing going on there.
Are you going to try to come back for Ebert Fest, free up your time, and then people will think you've never left?
Right. No, Chaz, you know, once I told her, you know, I was moving, she said, okay, I want you to come back in 2016 and just come back as a VIP and sit back and enjoy the festival and not have to plan it. So, yeah, I mean, I'm sure I'll come back for sure.
That was Mary Susan Britt, the Associate Director of Ebert Fest for the past 14 years. This year, she's saying goodbye, and it's time for us to say goodbye now, too. If you're not ready yet, you can find more pictures, audio, and notes on our website at willnews.org. You have been listening to Thumbs Up, WILL Looks at Ebert Fest 2015, a WILL production. We hope you have enjoyed our look at Ebert Fest. This show was produced by Jeff Bossert and myself. I'm Amanda Hunnickfort. Thank you for listening.